watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Finner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The period of European history following the collapse of the Roman Empire has been called the Dark Ages because of its domination by superstition. It is characterized as a time of mass ignorance and hostility to reason and science, and a lack of technological development, which is, in our culture, synonymous with progress. The Roman Empire and its collapse is the metaphor for the social critique put forward by the speaker we're going to hear in the first half of the program, and it has echoes in the deliberate construction of national ignorance that is emerging from our ongoing reading of John Taylor Gatto's book on American education, which will continue in the second half of the program. Our first speaker, Morris Berman, is a scholar and critic of Western cultural and intellectual history. His recent book, Dark Ages America, The Final Phase of Empire, uses a comparison to the fall of Rome to analyze our present society. Berman's presentation is very dark, and he mourns for the passing of an America that barely existed. In the question period that follows his talk, his audience challenges him on that point. Chaos and a degraded society are said to have followed the fall of Rome, but that is a matter of perspective. Friedrich Engels wrote in The Origin of the Family, quote, "Oppression by Roman officials and great landlords had become so heavy that many Romans fled into districts already occupied by the barbarians, and the Roman citizens settled there feared nothing so much as a return to Roman rule," close quote. One-third of the population of the Roman Empire were slaves. After the fall of Rome, we had the rise of the Roman Church that, through European monarchies, went on a global rampage of conquest and enslavement, especially in the Americas. This was during the so-called Renaissance period. This was then taken over by the British Empire and then the American one that consciously modeled itself on the Roman Republic. This during the so-called Age of Enlightenment. When the Europeans first landed, wherever on these continents they came ashore, they were met by people offering food and hospitality. What happens to people who arrive on these shores now? Who is civilized and who is not? Rome flattered itself too much, and so do we. If this were indeed the final phase of empire, it would be a very good thing, because 2,500 years of Roman and Roman-inspired so-called civilization is more than enough, marble columns notwithstanding. Here is Morris Berman, visiting scholar in the sociology department at the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C. This talk was given last spring in Charlottesville, Virginia, as part of a tour for his 2006 book, Dark Ages America, The Final Phase of Empire.
The original proposal for the book was written in December of 2001, 2 months after 9/11. And at that time, the title was Colossus Adrift. I saw it as a sequel to The Twilight of American Culture. I had not planned to write a sequel, but after 9/11, something became very clear to me. In The Twilight of American Culture, what I do is make a comparison on a structural basis between Rome and the late empire period and contemporary America. But the idea is that it was done entirely from the inside, internal factors to Rome and the United States. That was the comparison. The only thing is that this was published 15 months before 9/11. One thing I did not foresee was that the factors that I saw in common between the United States and the Roman Empire that were basically pulling the United States apart, I predicted that things would get worse in twilight of American culture, but it was from the point of benign neglect. In other words, I thought we would pay no attention to those factors and things would just get worse and worse over time. I never imagined that an administration would come to power that would deliberately try to make them worse, aggressively go ahead, you know, to make these things. That I never imagined. The other thing I didn't see, you know, except in hindsight, was the most obvious point of comparison between Rome, the decline of Rome, and the decline of the United States. Rome was invaded. It was attacked from the outside. It entered into a war of attrition, and it did not survive. And that was so clear that that was what was happening to us now. Among other things, we did all the wrong things in response to that attack. And so, as a result, I never imagined I would write a second book on American history, and there I was, you know, deep into it, because that parallel strikes me as a very important thing. It's kind of interesting, you know, when I say that we did all the wrong things. Winston Churchill once remarked that America could always be counted on to do the right thing after it exhausted all of the alternatives. You know? And, you know, there's a lot of truth to that. But in this case, we didn't bother with alternatives. We found the worst thing we could do, and we did it in spades, you know. It was sort of like the Roman empires were saying to George Bush, here's how to ruin the country. Go ahead. So the book was called Colossus Adrift, but as I began to work on it, I had to change the title because I realized we weren't merely adrift. We weren't in a late empire phase anymore. We had entered a kind of medieval period. We had entered the early Dark Ages. And so in the introduction to the book, I lay out the four things that I think represent the medievalization of the United States. The first is the triumph of religion over reason. This can be seen in the majority belief in the biblical version of creation. I think only something like a third of the American population takes Darwin seriously. If you can believe it, the 59% belief, that is to say 59% of the American population, according to Time magazine poll, believe in the apocalypse and the rapture. We also have the Bush administration opposition to science, nation scientists are up in arms about, and the frank and declared commitment to a faith-based, quote-unquote, foreign policy. A couple of years ago, the New York Times reporter Ron Suskind interviewed a number of Bush policy advisors, and he was told that he, that is Suskind, was living, quote, in the reality-based community, where solutions emerge, quote, from judicious study. This apparently was a bad thing. That's what the advisor was saying to Suskind. One senior advisor told Suskind, and I quote, "That's not the way the world really works anymore. We're an empire now, and when we act, we create our own reality." You know, as Dr. Phil likes to say, "How's that working out for you?" You know, look around. Just look around. Well, since fundamentalism and democracy are not very compatible, we should not be surprised that the opposition of many Americans to the Bill of Rights. 3 years ago, the University of Connecticut conducted a State of the First Amendment survey, and it discovered that 34% of those polled said the First Amendment goes too far, 46% said there was too much freedom of the press, 28% felt newspapers should not be able to publish articles without the prior approval of the government. These people apparently like Pravda and Izvestia, you know. And 50% felt the government should have the right to infringe on the freedom of, quote, certain religious groups. Let me say they did not mean the Baha'is. That was not what was implied here. Quite honestly, I would have to say we may be only one more terrorist attack away from a police state. If you have not caught up on the recent data about the NSA spying on hundreds of millions of American citizens and collecting a gigantic database, which then is matched in terms of who calls who, I mean, they are not just tracking on terrorists, unless there are 200 million terrorists in the United States, you know. There's a purpose to collect all this, and there are very sophisticated computer programs to hook things up, you know. All this is being done with the consent of the governed. There is not a lot of, there is not a lot of objection, or any that I know of, objection on the part of the American people to this revelation, to what the NSA is doing. In fact, when Newsweek broke the story on July 19th, 2004, that the White House had been talking with the Department of Justice for several months on the feasibility of canceling or postponing the presidential election in November, there was no reaction to that at all. I mean, the American public was not up in arms. They didn't say anything. Because that's okay, cancel the election for the first time in our history. Now, there is no objection on the part of the American people to torturing, to spying, to phony wars. There's no objection at all. The second item, I guess this might go along with it, the breakdown of education and critical thinking in the United States. As far as, I mean, I do some things with anecdotal evidence in the book, and I tend to keep collecting these just because they're so sad and funny, you know. Jay Leno has this segment on his program called Jaywalking, where he just goes out, talks to people in the streets of Burbank. Recently, well, a couple months ago, he had a thing called the Jaywalking All-Stars, where he invited it was the smartest or the dumbest, I can't remember, back to the show to answer questions. And some of the questions and answers were, of what country was Napoleon the Emperor? Answer, Idaho. Where would you be if you were speaking Farsi in a Farsi? What was Richard Nixon's nickname? Well, nobody knew. So finally he said, well, he was called Tricky Dick. So there was a silence, and one woman said, well, that's not very nice. So you have 4 years of college, and that's the level of analysis. Well, that's not very nice. So some of the recent ones, a couple weeks ago, he had them back. What's another name for the war between the states? Answer, what states? Question, what were the gay 90s? Answer, when everybody started coming out. What started the Great Depression? The immigrants. See, my parents caused the depression. Yeah. How many pints are there in a quart? Answer, aren't there four quarts in a pint? This is after 4 years of college. Just taking the younger generation, 18 to 24, those are nice anecdotes, but let me give you the stats. 87% of that age group can't find Iraq or Iran on a world map. They can go there and die, but they can't find it on a world map. 49% can't find New York State on a map of the United States. 29% can't locate the Pacific Ocean. And 11% can't find the United States. You know, that's really talented in a certain way. You know, I mean, it's remarkable. You know, I remember, it reminds me of this op-ed piece that H.L. Mencken did after Warren Gamaliel Harding's inaugural address. I mean, he was also intellectually challenged. Mencken wrote, it's so bad a sort of grandeur creeps into it. You know, that's how I think of these statistics. You know. General adult population, 40% don't know who our enemy was in World War II. 45% believe that space aliens have visited the Earth. This is one of my favorites. Kind of cute. 21% say the First Amendment guarantees the right to own pets. I kind of like that. Yeah. 58% don't know what the Patriot Act is. 25% have never heard of Al-Qaeda. Only 31% of college graduates are proficient in reading prose, and only 41% of graduate students. That's quite remarkable. You know, it's a certain type of achievement. 70% of American adults can't name their senators or congressmen. More than half don't know the actual number of senators. 63 can't name the three branches of government, et cetera, et cetera. The third factor in this medieval process is the return to torture on an official level. In fact, I think this is the first time in the modern period that torture has actually been legalized. I don't know, you know, for the French torture in Algeria, but they didn't write it into law. In fact, they were kind of ashamed of it, you know. But we've actually written it into law now. We've rewritten the law so that torture is legal, and the person who did that, Alberto Gonzalez, in Orwellian fashion, is made head of the Department of Justice. Okay? Remember in 1984, the Ministry of Freedom? You know, it wasn't about freedom. Okay? Orwell's comment then that when fascism comes to the United States, well, the West, it would come in the name of freedom, I think is really well said here. Actually, torture began under Clinton as an official policy. I mean, we were torturing in Vietnam, true. But as an official policy, Clinton started a program in 1995 called Extraordinary Rendition. This was when we began transferring suspected terrorists to countries such as Egypt, Syria, and Morocco to do our dirty work for us. And the dirty work routinely includes hanging prisoners from the ceiling, fracturing their spines, using electrical shocks, tearing their fingernails out, etc., etc. When Al Gore dropped the phrase American Gulag, he wasn't kidding. The CIA and Pentagon have a large network of detention centers that, in fact, today, the UN condemned. The UN just released a report. Waterboarding, which was the favorite technique of Latin American dictators, in which you nearly drown a suspect, is the favorite at Guantanamo as well. The UN suggested Guantanamo get shut down. You know, fat chance of that, I would say. Not a very pretty picture. The fourth factor that I think is indicative that we're passing from the scene is the marginalization of the U.S. on the world stage. China seems likely to overtake us economically. The European Union is already ahead of us scientifically. We continue to sink deeply into debt, both nationally and in terms of a huge trade deficit. In fact, the trade deficit is about $8 trillion now and growing daily, and the national debt is through the roof. We're being kept afloat by huge loans from Europe, Japan, and China to support a lifestyle that is kind of wasteful, really. Sooner or later, they're going to pull the plug. What happens then? What happens when OPEC shifts from dollars to euros as an exchange? Economists as centrist as Paul Volcker, who is head of the Fed, who was the Fed in the late 70s, have said, well, there will probably be a major crash and a devaluation of the dollar of about 25%. Maybe 5 to 7 years is what he's predicting. In terms of health, the World Health Organization 2 years ago did a study of healthcare systems around the world. The United States ranked 37th. That's kind of interesting. If you ask most Americans, they would say, oh, we're the best. In fact, Saudi Arabia came in 26th. Okay, probably if you get sick, you're better off going to Riyadh General than the University of Virginia. That's a strange thought, isn't it? So recently, I have to say, about just 2 weeks ago, there was an article in The New Scientist that was an American-British study, comparative of the health level of Americans and Brits. I quote, the health of the richest people in the United States is as poor as the worst educated, lowest paid among the English. You know, just think of that. You know, we laugh at national health. They're doing a whole lot better than free enterprise. Some of my readers have asked me if I'm planning to do a third volume. They said, you know, you did Twilight, now you've done Night, basically. Will you give us Dawn? History doesn't work that way, unfortunately. It would be nice to have a renaissance, that would be wonderful, but collapsed empires tend to stay collapsed. That's the pattern. In the case of Rome, the reawakening began in the 11th century, and it wasn't in Italy. It was in Northern Europe, the urban revival, and it was 600 years after the fall of Rome. In fact, about Rome, I would have to say that the Roman Empire did not so much as fall away. It didn't get a second chance, and I don't think we will either. 30 years ago, the Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas wrote, as nightfall does not come at once, neither does oppression. In both instances, there is a twilight when everything remains unchanged. And it is in such twilight that we all must be most aware of change in the air, lest we become unwitting victims of the darkness. Well, that prediction happened. We were not aware of the change in the air. The change did take place. This is no longer twilight. We are now in Dark Ages America. What would it take for us to start doing something different? 2 days after 9/11, Chalmers Johnson remarked in an interview, I know it sounds cruel to say, but the people of New York were collateral damage of American foreign policy, end of quote. Iraq was part of our Middle Eastern shadow, left over from 1991. September 11th was the delayed collateral damage that ensued, the shadow made manifest. Instead of figuring this out, the U.S. government chose to repeat the cycle after a short and apparently botched pursuit of Osama bin Laden with even greater intensity, completing the process whereby the Cold War was replaced by the terror war. And terror, as Patrick Buchanan rightly remarks, is the price of empire. The two go hand in hand. On December 6, 2004, The New Yorker ran a magazine cover that I found extremely haunting. The artwork in the shadows is by Carter Goodrich. The picture is of a street scene, perhaps in Midtown Manhattan, with Americans festively dressed doing their Christmas shopping. And there in the background, in the shadows, dressed like Santa and ringing a Salvation Army bell, is Osama bin Laden, a watchful and sober expression on his face. The message is very clear here. Here in the midst of luxury, luxury enjoyed at the expense of third world poverty and misery, is America's guilty conscience. For whom does the bell toll then? For us. But we don't seem to be able to hear it. How long before Al-Qaeda detonates a nuclear device in a major American city? Something like that is coming, for Osama bin Laden is no fool. He doesn't expect the American people to pay any attention to anything he says. Rather, the purpose of his public statements is to win sympathy from the Arab world for such an attack, having said, in effect, I warned them again and again, but they just wouldn't listen. Graham Allison of Harvard University's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs and the author of Nuclear Terrorism points out that it is not all that difficult for a terrorist group to manufacture a nuclear bomb if it can acquire the requisite amount of weapons-grade uranium-235. Reflecting on the possibility of this happening, a friend of mine wrote, we can change our policies now toward a legitimized form of the global rule of law, or after one or more cities are destroyed and our economy goes totally bankrupt. I responded, I have no doubt as to what our choice is going to be. Oddly enough, I believe the culture already understands this on an intuitive level. These sorts of predictions or insights frequently surface in a creative context, as on the New Yorker cover. In an episode of the TV series Jack and Bobby, which aired in December 2004, this is a narrative that partly projects a future scenario of America in the 2040s, when we are no longer the world's leading power, a politician looks back on the events of September 12, 2041, and relates how an Islamic fundamentalist group drove a truck into Midtown Chicago and detonated a nuclear warhead. The only thing dubious about this scenario, I'm guessing, is that it probably won't take 30-plus years for such an event to occur. By failing to grasp the meaning of 9/11 and 1-911 in America, of course, in cases of emergency, we managed to convince ourselves that what was in fact profound structural weakness was instead the apex of American power. This is a tragic confusion. Denial would be more accurate, and it will cost us dearly. Rome, writes Harvard University's Joseph Nye, succumbed not to the rise of a new empire, but to internal decay and the death of 1,000 cuts from various barbarian groups, unquote. If the meaning of 9/11 was a wake-up call, the lesson of 9/11 is that we learn nothing at all. And beneath this willful ignorance is the deeper layer I mentioned earlier, the void. It is this that we fear above all else. Just a century ago, the Greek poet Constantine Cavafy wrote a poem called Waiting for the Barbarians, in which he describes the Romans assembled in the forum, waiting for the barbarians to show up at the gates. They wait and wait, but the barbarians fail to come. Cavafy concludes, why this sudden bewilderment, this confusion? How serious people's faces have become. Why are the streets and squares emptying so rapidly, everyone going home lost in thought? Because night has fallen and the barbarians haven't come. And some of our men just in from the border say there are no barbarians any longer. Now what's going to happen to us without barbarians? They were those people, a kind of solution. Putting the enemy out there, quote unquote, is indeed a kind of solution, a way of keeping the void at bay. It solves the problem of having no inherent purpose, or perhaps no purpose at all, and as the Buddhists say, would that be so bad? As long as we can't live with empty space, so to speak, our choices are not really choices. They are merely compulsions. Reviewing Robert Lowell's collected poems, Tom Pollan comments that Lowell, quote, knows the heart of darkness in the American imperial sublime. Here's the end of Lowell's poem, Waking Early Sunday Morning. Pity the planet, all joy gone from the sweet volcanic cone. Peace to our children when they fall in small war, on the heels of small war. Until the end of time, to police the earth, a ghost orbiting forever, lost in our monotonous sublime. So we missed the boat on 9/11. We decided to continue policing the earth more dramatically than we ever had until the end of time. This decision is turning us into ghosts as we enter the dark ages in earnest. Choosing the road not taken, to quote a different Robert, would have required something really remarkable, and I don't think history provides us with a single example of a nation that managed to take that path. This is not a happy conclusion for me to come to, and in some ways this has been a painful book to write. After all, I wouldn't be here today without the largesse of America. And when in 1920 my family steamed past the Statue of Liberty and on toward Ellis Island, it was the most dramatic moment of their lives. My mother used to tell the story of her father, who at some point after World War II, upon finding a small American flag on the ground, picked it up, dusted it off, and brought it home to put on the mantelpiece, saying, if not for this, we would have all perished in Auschwitz. I agree with the historian Walter McDougall when he writes, quote, no large nation on earth has provided more stability, prosperity, security, and liberty to more people than has the United States, end of quote. This was the glory of America, to be a land of great promise, a refuge from political tyranny, a place of immense creative energy and the world locus of political freedom. But the glory had a shadow, a set of structural problems that were present quite early on and that eventually landed us in a very different and inglorious place. Those of us who now have different values from the country may have to look elsewhere for hope, quality, humanism, and possibly freedom, which is not exactly what we had in mind when we were growing up. And although it would be a fabulous turn of events, it is nevertheless very unlikely that the solution to the American dilemma can come from within America itself. The zeitgeist, it would seem, is moving on. Thanks very much.
I've got a question. I want to compare Rome to the United States also, and I'm going to contend that Rome was never in good shape.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
I mean, 100 years ago, there were a few white, wealthy people that enjoyed these freedoms you just quoted, but most people did not. Most people did not enjoy prosperity, and many did not enjoy civil rights.
That's right.
So
that's true.
Why are we worse off today? Why are we disintegrating today when everything was in place for disintegration 100 years ago?
Yeah. It's an interesting thing. I think we were actually, you're right, I mean, those weaknesses were certainly present. And in fact, I have a whole section on American value systems in the colonies in the 1790s and how by the time Jefferson got elected, certain things were in place that essentially were working against us and just took a long time to play out. And that's part of it. These things take a long time to play out. Part of it is that there is a kind of dialectical principle at work, which is kind of funny when it applies to civilizations. And that is, by dialectical, I mean the things and their opposites are related. So that the very things that allowed us to expand as a nation, for example, what I see is the sunny face of the United States, technology, entrepreneurship, extreme individualism, the Yankee can-do mentality, all of that. That enabled our economy to expand, our frontier to expand, all that sort of thing. And that was the rising cusp, although there's another history that you're talking about that definitely is there. But the problem of the dialectical problem is that after a while, you can't keep doing that without doing yourself a lot of damage. In other words, the very things that allowed you to expand then turn against you and become nails in your coffin. Now, a person in midlife who might realize this about themselves, I suppose, can go to a therapist, you know, and say, well, I want to work on this or something like that. A nation can't go to a therapist. And it also can't turn on a dime. It can't then start to say, well, we're going to do things very, very differently. That's why I make a lot out in this book out of Jimmy Carter, because he was the one person that comes along in the post-war period and says, we're going to do things differently. And you know what happened to him. He's a figure of ridicule when the truth is he was probably the most heroic post-war American president we had. He's now a joke. If we saw him as heroic, and somebody, let's say, like Ronald Reagan is a joke, we would be on our way towards some sort of recovery. That will not happen. That will not happen.
I agree with you about Carter. I'm just saying the sunny face of America mm-hmm. expansion, I don't think any expansion took place without killing people.
Yeah, that's right.
Period. I mean,
yeah.
Not at all. Nobody said, oh, I can't wait to join the United States.
All right.
We took it.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah. No.
It has been that way since day one, and there's nothing different now.
Right, but there, you see, the expansion worked, is what I'm saying. By something like 1875, we were the major manufacturer on the planet. You know, I mean, that's what I'm talking about. I'm not denying that there's a hidden history.
But even there, that's not because of technology. We were the major manufacturer on the back of people that we were abusing.
Right, right. And one
not
might...
Not because we were so smart, but because we were so brutal.
Well, that may be a point.
Yeah, because,
right.
Well, you don't think...
Beer, cheers.
Andrew Carnegie was not a brute. He was a brute.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, that's true. It's just, there is a hidden history here that you're talking about, and it works very well for a certain period of time, but not for the people that are suppressed by that. The only thing I'm saying is that the system expands, at least in the public view, and in terms of things like gross domestic product, ownership of land, it expands. And then finally, that doesn't work anymore. That doesn't mean that the things you're talking about were not present. They were, but it didn't stop that expansion. And as you say, it may have promoted it. And it may be true that civilizations do that in general, but finally there are limits to what happens. I think we've reached it. In fact, I would say the period of earnest decline in the United States began in the early 70s. Yes, sir?
That's what I was thinking about. Engine people's probably figured that torture has been an official policy for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, like, if it would crash, if something like, say, a given police state would cut in, like now, that how many U.S. troops would never even get a chance to defend this country?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you know that T-shirt that shows a bunch of Native Americans running around and it says the first terrorists? Mm-hmm. You know, something like that. So, you know, that's absolutely right. You had a question?
Knowing what you know, and for people who feel and see the world like you do, how do you cope?
Good question. Well, you know, I've been asked this a lot on the lecture tour I've been going on. And what I have to say is that for me, as I said, this was a painful book to write because I didn't really realize how bad it was when I started out. I mean, I didn't really, when you do the record of what the CIA has done in the post-war period to legitimately elected governments, you know, Guatemala, Chile, and so on, this is quite depressing. So I didn't quite realize, you know, I also didn't realize that if you put together all the structural factors, you really arrive at a no-exit situation. Because how are you going to reverse all that? They interlock very well. The only thing I can say is that for me, as a researcher, the truth gets me high. In other words, I find it exciting to find the story of what happened between Plymouth Rock and Dead End Rock. You know, I mean, it's quite an interesting adventure, and for me, it's been exciting just to put those pieces together. I'm sorry I had to come to the conclusion I did in a certain way, but what I mean, if you're serious about research, whatever's there is there. It's not a question of what makes you feel good. The job of the truth is just to be the truth, not to make you feel good. And that's how I feel about it. I mean, to me, it's very powerful. And I have to say that a lot of the email messages I've gotten from readers essentially have been quite positive, emotionally very upbeat, in the sense of saying, it's really important to me to know what actually exists. I do not want to be told that I should meditate, join some grassroots organization, none of that will work. What I want to know is what's happening and how it happened. You put the pieces together for me. So I think there are people that feel that. It's very powerful to know what the stakes are. Yeah. Yes, Lou and Jack?
How do you make sense of something like what happened in New Orleans? How do you tie that in to your view of what's
happening? Right. That tore the face off of any pretense that we have about taking care of people. Not that we have a lot. Pardon?
I mean, where's the outrage? I never dreamed I would see.
There wasn't any. There wasn't any outrage. No, there wasn't any outrage. In fact, it was just the story of the week, and then we went on to something else, which is what the press is about in the United States, you know. And, I mean, the first thing, you know, I make a lot in the book about the tie between what I call the macrocosm and the microcosm. In other words, you learn an awful lot about large-scale policies, whether foreign and domestic, if you look at very tiny events in our lives. You know, just individual. On a, you know, for example, I live in an apartment building where people barely hold the doors for each other. I kid, it's not that much of an exaggeration that if I died in the lobby, the other residents would be annoyed that there was a corpse blocking their way to the mailboxes. It's only a slight exaggeration, you know. This describes an awful lot of buildings in the United States, unfortunately. The attitude is, you know, I've said in the book, instead of on the nickel, instead of In God We Trust, it should read, What's in It for Me? You know, because that's really our motto. That, and, you know, and that was part of the value system I talked about in the 1790s. There was a shift from an organic European federalist view that the good citizen is a person who serves their community to the Jeffersonian Republican view. The virtue is being successful in a competitive environment. That shift occurred over the 1790s. And what then happened was it institutionalized, with Jefferson's election, and institutionalized the notion that what's in it for me is the appropriate attitude for Americans, if not all human beings, which is in fact what we're trying to impose on all these other countries. That they should become markets and live like markets. And they're getting quite sick of it because it makes you physically and emotionally sick to live that way. That's why those health statistics are so bad. Why do you think we're so sick as a nation? We're actually sick physically because we treat each other like garbage, and we do it all the time, every day. And then you see Katrina, and this is not amazing. This is how we deal with each other. There's no social safety net in this country. As a matter of fact, the Germans had a better one in 1871 under Bismarck than we've got today. So there's no protection for people, and there's a belief that there shouldn't be any protection for people. And so when Katrina occurs, it's sort of like a little hand-wringing for about a week, and then we go on to the next event. We really don't care about those people, and we really don't care about people in general. What does that say what we care about the third world, or what our foreign policy is like? These are not accidents. These are not accidents. You know, we kill 100,000 Iraqi civilians. Most Americans are not aware of it, and if they were aware of it, they'd shrug their shoulders. I remember a woman, after Abu Ghraib broke, an Arab woman on American television, who just said in Arabic, they translated, I want to say this to American mothers, how would you feel if these were your sons? There was no answer at all from any woman's group or any group to this. I mean, the silence was deafening. That was the response. Nothing. We don't care. You know that very last episode of Seinfeld, you know, where they were arrested for violating a supposedly Good Samaritan law? And he calls up his attorney, which is a Johnny Cochran lookalike, Jackie Childs. You know, and he says, I was arrested for not helping people or something like that. And Jackie Childs says, you don't have to help anybody. That's what this country's all about. He got that right.
Why are you so disgusted when you say that, though?
Pardon?
I would say that not a single person in this group feels that way. And I don't know, the more people I talk to, the less I find that to be the case. And I'm just curious, you know, if you were to write a third volume and you could write the book you wanted to write,
this is what you wanted to write.
As opposed to the dystopia, the two previous dystopias.
Okay.
What would you call it? And don't you think it's the role of critical thinkers and writers, good writers, and people that see these patterns to offer us something? Offers a way out through the imagination. I still think America's open to interpretation, and I would argue that a lot of people still think that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've asked a lot of questions, so I don't know which ones to answer.
Well, yeah,
but let me take the one about pessimism. Okay, let me just take that because I can't answer the whole barrage. But I think that the function of the critical writer is to say what's there. It's not to make the audience happy. If it turns
to make them happy.
Not to make them optimistic. That's not the function of a critical writer. The critical writer is to say what they honestly think is the truth, whether it's positive or negative, whether it's optimistic or not optimistic. And that's what I saw myself as doing. Would I rather be able to say we'll pull out of this? Yes. Can I say that honestly? Absolutely not. I don't think that's going to occur. Okay. There was somebody. Yeah, madam.
Considering Clinton's impeachment, would you comment on the Congress's seeming relative shrugging of their shoulders over the things that Bush has done without talking, you know, about, well, I think a couple of our elected officials have spoken of impeachment.
Right. Yeah, John Conyers, you know, I mean, that sort of thing. But I don't think that's going to get very far. You can, and the United States is a curious country given its Puritan history. You can butcher hundreds of thousands of people, nobody bats an eye. You can have sex in the Oval Office and everybody's up in arms. You know? This is a curious country with regard to value system and prurience. You know, I mean, a kind of puritanical judgment. European countries just shake their heads over that impeachment. What were you thinking? You know, I mean, get on with the business of government, you know. We don't do that. I mean, we've got a kind of screwy value system, I think, with regard to that. Yes, sir.
If I'm wondering, I'm not a cultural historian, but I'm often caused to wonder about democracy and capitalism as a combination and whether we haven't reached where we are today as the end result of combining those two in a political system where money is what talks, and we have these offshore companies now, global industrial mm-hmm. complex that's tied into the oil, and they're offshore, and they have so much money that they control our media, they control our politics, and in fact they run everything in this country, and the politicians are in many ways, you know, in their hands because of the money that can be put in the hands of lobbyists to influence decision making. Have we had other cultures before us that were this unique combination of capitalism and democracy?
Well, the odd thing about America is that it's the first nation in the world that was born bourgeois. It had no feudal background. And although there's something very positive about that, because it's not like a return to feudalism would be a good thing, or, you know, aristocracy or whatever, there is a downside as well. Analytically, feudalism is probably the basis of the welfare state in Europe. And some observers have said, no feudalism, no socialism. In other words, what you do learn in feudalism is noblesse oblige. You have the responsibility to take care of other people. That's how a hierarchical system works. In an egalitarian system, we all think this is a good thing, but there are some drawbacks. You're on your own. Nobody's going to take care of you. And so, these are the types of things that historically play out in a certain way. The conjunction of money and democracy evolved over a long period of time, but we did start out as the only nation in the world that was born bourgeois. It never came out of an organic hierarchical society. And there are positives and negatives to that. And another negative, of course, is that if you join money with democracy, it really becomes about money, not about democracy. Finally, that's what you're exporting to the third world. And so, you know, one of the first things that Paul Bremer did as proconsul of Iraq was to open the doors to Burger King. I mean, I couldn't imagine anything more symbolic. You know, here's democracy. Would you like it, you know, quarter pounder? I mean, you know, that was democracy. And in his mind, too. In his mind, too. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Considering the last two presidential elections were very close, isn't it possible that we could get it if with the right, you know, charismatic candidate or something, we could go into a different regime where there were different values?
I don't see the values as different, and that's the thing. Kerry was the most militaristic candidate by the Democratic Party since James Polk, and if he had been in office, elected, I don't think. what you get between the, I mean, the difference to me between the Republicans and Democrats is empire and empire light. There is no such thing as becoming president in this country since 1945 without making it clear that you will serve the national security state. That's what you have to do. And that means certain things. The Democrats can flirt with the idea of a social safety net and so on, but basically the values are pretty similar. And as a result, it's not like we're going to get a thoroughly different set of values. As I said earlier, Jimmy Carter represented that, but he couldn't possibly last under that. You know, the Americans weren't going to have it. One way or another, in contemporary terms, not Jimmy Carter, but most recently, I would say the candidate that most represented something that was very, very different was the Democratic primary candidate, Dennis Kucinich, who had been mayor of Cleveland, I think it was. His platform was really radically different. Of course, he got 0.00001% of the vote. That's what happened to Dennis Kucinich. Because within the American mindset, those values are unrecognizable. If you say we should pull out of all these countries that we've set up army bases in, we should apologize to what we've done to Chile, Vietnam, Guatemala, the Middle East, and so on. We should not get involved in their affairs. And we should set up a social safety net for everybody. I mean, that president would last 4 seconds in office. You know, I mean, he'd be impeached immediately. So it's not like we can get somebody in there with radically different values. The Democrats and Republicans are two shades. I mean, Gore Vidal years ago said, what we've got in the United States is one party with two right wings. I'm afraid that's correct. Yeah. Yes, sir?
Comment on that. First of all, of course, that is a Democratic result, the fact that Kucinich did not win more than 0.001% of the vote.
That's a Democratic result?
That was a Democratic result. Democracy worked, right?
Oh, I see. Okay.
Right. No, we don't want that.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
But there's another narrative that we could have over the course of this doom and gloom that you're propounding here. During my lifetime, I see the expansion of civil rights. I've seen the economy triple in size over that time. Mm-hmm. The average wages have gone up enormously over that period of time, as well as the amount of things that we're able to do and buy, and the education that we have, expansion going on. I mean, the fact of the matter is that, in fact, all of our lives have gotten vastly better than they were 30 years ago.
Not all. Part.
No, the vast majority.
No. Yeah. Not all.
One would have to take each of those things and deconstruct them, because the difference between appearance and reality on those is very great. And step by step, you know, if you look at them, it's not actually, I mean, the actual buying power now is quite less than it was before because of inflation.
I'm sorry, that's nuts.
Not really.
Yes,
and I don't think
I'm
so.
I'm not going to let you say something that's not factually the case and get away with it.
Well, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. The thing is that structurally things can look one way, but on another. For example, you can look at the stock market and you say it's expanding. Well, actually, it collapsed a bit last week. Or the real estate market is better, or something like that. We've got an $8 trillion foreign debt. We've got a national debt that's colossal. You have mainstream economists predicting that this whole situation is unstable and we're riding a bubble. I mean, in all of those cases that you mentioned, believe me, there's another side. And, you know, I go into it at length in the book, that there is a big difference between appearance and reality. So things can look pretty good. They're not. Somebody else? Yes.
Lots of empires, when they were defeated, then enjoyed periods of peace and prosperity when they didn't have to be the tough guy anymore, and they didn't have to swagger and flex their muscles. Is there not a way, short of nuclear terrorism, that we can go ahead and back off or divide and flourish or something, do something different?
Yeah, I mean, I think of somebody like, you know, a nation like England, for example. It's not like England fell off the planet. You know, I mean, the English go on, and there's life in England, and so on. They just don't happen to be an empire anymore. I don't know, but you know, it's that life goes on. But in the case of England, England's an interesting example because it had a backup, namely us. it could pass the torch on to us. And in fact, that was the agreement between Roosevelt and Churchill, that that's what would happen. So we don't have anybody to pass the torch on to. We have serious rivals in the world, you know, like China and the European Union and so on. And so I don't know how we'll fare, but the statistics you were pointing out earlier of the underbelly of things, you know, you've got a situation where 45 million Americans have no health care and no prospect of getting it. The actual poverty line, as defined, has 30 million people below it. But that, which is something like $11,500 for a family of four, is whatever it is, it's quite unrealistic. The truth about poverty is much larger than just 30 million people below the poverty line. So it's sort of like, yes, life goes on, and maybe we can enjoy things, but who is it that's going to enjoy things, and what percentages are we talking about? Which is really what you were talking about earlier.
Well, I'm just saying that that we've gotten ourselves in a fix by... Mm-hmm. Having to be, if not the policeman of the world, the policeman of the values that we
right.
espouse.
Right.
And is there any way to not do that anymore?
Not that I know of. Again, I come back to Carter. That was what he was really trying to do, and the American people were not having it any more than they were going to have Dennis Kucinich.
Can that not happen from the bottom up, though? Like it's happening in this room right now? I mean, can that happen from the bottom up?
Well, happening in this room. We're having a discussion about it.
Which
but
is a step in the right direction.
Yes, yes, but what's it going to take? In other words, when people say to me, okay, maybe it could be different. My response to that is, show me the levers of power. You show me where the power lies that things could be different. And for God's sakes, don't point to the Democratic Party. They're a joke. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, they're intellectually bankrupt and politically impotent. So let's not talk about Hillary or something like this. But the question is, where does the power lie? It's got to be, it can't be a bunch of people talking about things. It's a start. Better to have it than not have it.
There's a remnant of our system that is still open to people to, genuine democratic, communitarian kind of action on a daily basis. Like, I don't know. Do you not still think that there are some structural outlets for some sort of meaningful change?
I'd just like to see them. I mean, in terms of real power that could turn things
right.
around, I see people living, wanting to live different lives, and you can probably do that.
Right.
But actually securing power so that the United States moves in a different direction, I don't know where those levers are. I mean, it's certainly not moveon.org. Yeah.
Two comments. One is, I don't know, you probably are familiar with Barbara Tuchman's Margin of Folly. And I'm reminded of that every great or powerful entity has known what it was doing and marched into it anyway, which is kind of what you're saying.
Yeah.
Had all the resources to know and yet can't pull back.
Right.
And she takes seven different examples of that. My comment is kind of in direction of this young man. And has to do with hope, and I think it's hope that's keeping us immobile.
That's interesting. Say more about that.
Well, when you were talking about Katrina, nobody cared. A lot of people did care, and people did work at that for a long time. And the problem is that then belies this collective not caring.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we will send clothing, or even drive clothing and water to Louisiana, but we won't go to Washington and tear the government apart.
Yeah, right.
And the reason is because things like our response to Karina give us hope that somehow we're really not like that, or really not going there.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as we have hope, we're not going to do what they do in South America, which is put our bodies on the street and be willing to be killed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you're not there, then I don't see anything powerful enough.
It's well been said that charity is the bourgeois form of justice. You know, I mean, finally, what does it amount to? People feel good for a week or two. Then we're back, you know. There was a famous Latin American political organizer. He's probably dead, you know. But he made a statement, when I distribute food to the poor, the ruling class applauds. And when I try to teach the poor why they're poor, they come after me with guns. You know, I mean, right.
But do you walk the walk? I mean, do you go to this stuff all week?
I'm not an activist. You know, that's not what I'm doing.
You're trying to make money off your books, but like, I don't see you doing it. I don't see you going out.
I'm sorry. I'm not saying I'm an activist. You are missing the point here. I am not claiming to be an activist. That's not the claim.
I'm the youngest person in this audience, and I want to hear something else. I mean,
well, go to a different lecture. You had a question.
I'd like to applaud you for doing something very important, and that is to create a sense of discomfort in people, because it's that sense of discomfort that can ultimately, you know, if it's acute enough, can actually do something. I'm a high school teacher, and one of the things that I do is try to teach current events, and I find myself in the same position you are, which is, or maybe different, which is how to put aspects of the truth as I see it together in a way that doesn't, I'm aware of not depressing young people, and I find that it doesn't depress young people. They enjoy my class as one of the best ones around, and I think it's because it gives them a sense, it verifies something that they feel internally but doesn't see a way of connecting them.
Well, I tell you, that's the major feedback. I thought I'd get a lot of hate mail. The major feedback I've gotten is thank you. And it's because I'm not attempting to fool anybody. And the thing about, I mean, one person said to me about the book, you know, there is a thing in certain schools of therapy called a shock metaphor. In the shock metaphor, you lay out the worst case scenario and say, if you don't like it, propose how it would be different. Now, I've done that in a certain way. And if people, I mean, I'm certainly open to somebody coming up and saying, these are the levers of power, these how to change it. Because personally, I don't see it, but I'm certainly open to that. I remember I think it was in Boulder, I was giving a talk, and one fellow, he's about 21 years old, and he came up and he was practically in tears. You know, he said, I believe in the vision of the Founding Fathers, and I want to do something to implement it. I said, don't let me get in your way. Go do it. You know, more power to you. I don't see how it can happen, but I'm certainly not going to say go fishing. You know, I mean, if he wants to do that, that's great. Yeah.
Could you speak to the new monastic individualism that you spoke about?
Sure.
in the twilight of American culture? And because I think that gets into some of what the guy that left here, he was, you know, something that
right.
a positive, a hopeful, and activist role, because I got a lot out of that when you
right.
laid out of the various people who are doing something structurally
right.
different out here. And secondly, could you speak to also to this gentleman was talking about how, well, a lot of the brutality and injustice and mm-hmm. a lot of these things have been around for a long time. But two things that have certainly changed over the last 100, 200 years of this country have been the vast technological increase and the vast population increase, not just in this country, but everywhere in the world.
Right.
And so I wonder how much of this, of the decay that's going on is a result of those things, not necessarily political structure, things
yeah.
like this.
Yeah.
To me, I think China is doomed as much as anybody on the planet.
That's a good question.
And a lot of these nations that are trying to succeed at a high technological level and have vast numbers of people, I don't see how a finite world can
right.
possibly accommodate that. Regardless.
Let me answer your question. I'm holding my hand here because that light is right in my eye, and I can't see you unless I do that. So I'm sorry about that. As far as China goes, or the point you make about beyond political issues.
Right, I mean, the technology.
Right, let me answer you.
Yeah,
let me answer you.
And also the new monastic.
Okay, yeah, I will. The first thing is that the ecological situation could possibly catch up to us before the political one does. You're absolutely right about that. And I have a whole discussion in the book about how technology has developed over the last 100 years in this country. We may be in a situation of that things would crash economically because they're crashing ecologically.